My name is Christian Ashley, a seminary student and servant of God, and you are listening to the Let Nothing Move You podcast, a proud Anazal Ministries podcast.
Welcome back, everyone, to the next episode of the Let Nothing Move You podcast. I'm your host, Christian Ashley. As we continue on through the book of Judges, today we're going to be in Judges 8 and 9, finishing the Gideon saga, as it were, alongside his son Abimelech and the terrible things that happened as a result of that. So without any further ado, let's just go ahead and get into this one. We'll be starting in chapter 8 in verses 1 through 9. Then the men of Ephraim said to him, Gideon, "What is this that you have done to us, not to call us when you went to fight against Midian?" And they accused him fiercely. And he said to them, "What have I done now in comparison with you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the grape harvest of Abiezer? God has given into your hands the princes of Midian, Oreb and Zeb. What have I been able to do in comparison with you?" Then their anger against him subsided when he said this. And Gideon came to the Jordan and crossed over, he and the 300 men who were with him, exhausted yet pursuing. So he said to the men of Succoth, "Please give me loaves of bread to the people who follow me, for they are exhausted. And I am pursuing after Zeba and Zalmunna, the kings of Midian." And the officials of Succoth said, "Are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna already in your hand that we should give bread to your army?" So Gideon said, "Well then, when the Lord has given Zeba and Zalmunna into my hand, I will flail your flesh with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars." And from there he went up to Penuel and spoke to them in the same way. And the men of Penuel answered him as the men of Succoth had answered. And he said to the men of Penuel, "When I come again in peace, I will break down this tower." After achieving the initial victory, as you'll recall from last time, Gideon continues to press his advantage with, once again, only 300 men on his side. At his moment, there are still other people like the men of Ephraim he has called into action that are acting independently of him under his orders, but in an independent fashion. And as you'll recall from last time as well, they took down two of the princes of Midian. And now when we start chapter 8, we got to the point where like, okay, well, why didn't you bring us into this sooner? Like, hey, you were trying to take stuff away from us. Now, when you get your victory, now we can be included to be part of the spoils, is kind of the feelings they're getting. And what does Gideon do with this information? Does he spend his time explaining exactly the plans that God had? Yep, probably should have been his number one step. But instead, he does something that is still good. Don't get me wrong. Like, this is effective leadership. This is effective conflict management. It's like, look, guys, what have I done compared to you? Like, yeah, sure, we got that victory there. But you took out Oreb and Zeb. Did I do that? Did Gideon do that? No. Ephraim did that. And that's why we needed you. And this, of course, placates Ephraim as a tribe to go, oh, yeah, we did. We did part of this. We shared a victory today. You're right. In fact, we're on the same side, Gideon. Thank you for pointing that out. No, he's not just like playing to their pride or something like that, something evil and banal like that. No, he's like getting them to understand what they did. And like, he wasn't trying to like make them upset. He wasn't trying to like keep them away from anything. It's like, no, like, look, like you do, you were supposed to do, I did what I was supposed to do. So let's keep teaming up. It's, you know what? That makes sense. And he avoids a conflict that we shall see next time when Karai and I are doing Judges 10 through 12, where Ephraim kind of gets in their own way again. And Jephthah does not handle it as well as Gideon does. I will give that to Gideon. On the other hand, Gideon is not perfect in this chapter. When it comes to people of Succoth, some would say Succoth because they don't want to say the word suck. I don't know how it's supposed to actually be pronounced. Succoth is always how I heard it said. And Penuel, a real southern touch to say Penuel. Could be either one. End of the day, cities are gone. Who cares? They cause problems. And that's something we should care about. Or if you'll remember, these are people who've lived under the affliction of the Midianites and Amalekites and the people of the east for a very long time, several years. A very long time is any time I would specify that is more than once in this scenario where someone comes in, raids, takes everything I have. Once is enough, but no, many years is not exactly what I would call fun. So in their fear, what do these two cities do? They deny the Lord's chosen. Now, he's not meant to be their king or anything, but he's the one who's supposed to judge. He's got the Lord's seal of approval on him. And what do? Deny him food, sustenance. He's tired from doing something they couldn't do. So they're going to sit around pretending that they're going to be okay because, oh, well, what if Gideon loses? if Gideon loses and the Midianites find out that we helped out, then, oh no, I mean, they're going to get angry at us. They're going to try and murder us. No, instead, what happens? They give in to their fear, their anxiety, and they refuse to look at what the good things God has done for them are, and they seal themselves away. Unacceptable. Completely and utterly unacceptable for any person to do in this scenario, and completely and utterly unacceptable for any church to act in this way. We are not some isolationist group of people who never interact with the world outside, and we also should never be the kind of people who never interact with other churches. Now, don't get me wrong. There are churches out there who will claim the name church and they will claim the name of Jesus, and they have nothing to do with either one. We don't associate with people like that as far as getting stuff done in a sense of let's all organize together certain events like this and make sure the gospel is being spread. No, you can still work with them in other projects, as mentioned other times, like if they've got a food shelter in place, get that work, actually have the gospel being presented with they're not sharing. I mean, it's already set up. Make it work even better with the gospel. Go for it. We'd be like, hey, we're going to organize against this bill that's being put before Congress. And it's, this says this, that, and that, and it has nothing to do with scripture. No, don't associate. A church is supposed to be active. People in the church are supposed to be active in living out their own lives around people who are not a part of the church, as well as people who are, but not in your church. The tribes of Israel were supposed to work in the same way. They were supposed to support one another. And the fact that they didn't shows just how far away these people were from God. These were their relatives. These were their people, and they couldn't do this kindness to Gideon, who had just protected them from countless people who wanted to ravage their land. I'm not going to say that they deserve what happens to them later on, but I understand why Gideon's upset. He makes two promises here. He's going to flail the first town, the people there, with their flesh with thorns of the wilderness with briars. Sounds terrible to me as someone who doesn't like pain. And then he's going to break down the Tower of Penuel. Sounds a little better to me out of the two options. But Gideon is also speaking a little rashly here. Now, there are some people out there, and I think they have evidence behind this, so I'm not going to totally discount them, that say that Gideon's actions here are completely and utterly righteous because they didn't work together with him. My counter to that is that nowhere in this is it explicitly stated in the text that God says, Gideon, avenge yourself on these people because they got in the way of you, the person I chose to be the judge of this land. So when it happens later on, the judgment in this sense, I think it's personal to Gideon that he wasn't listened to, he wasn't taken care of. So now as a personal slight against me, I'm going to take this out on you. But I still leave open the possibility that I'm wrong because that is not also explicitly stated in the text. But I think it would be more accurate and actually being a judgment from God if he had been spoken of at all in this sense. So you can take it or leave it. Those are the two main ways to look at what's about to happen and actually show what happens. Let's get into verses 10 through 21. Now Ziba and Zalmunna were in Karkor with their army, about 15,000 men, all who were left of all the army of the people of the east, for there had fallen 120,000 men who drew the sword. And Gideon went up by the way of the tent dwellers east of Nobah and Jogbaha, and attacked the army, for the army felt secure. And Ziba and Zalmunna fled, and he pursued them, and captured the two kings of Midian, Ziba and Zalmunna, and he threw all the army into a panic. Then Gideon, the son of Joash, returned from the battle by the ascent of Heres, and he captured a young man of Succoth and questioned him. And he wrote down for him the officials and elders of Succoth, 77 men. And he came to the men of Succoth and said, behold, Ziba and Zalmunna, about whom you taunted me, saying, are the hands of Ziba and Zalmunna already in your hand, that we should give bread to your men who are exhausted? And he took the elders of the city, and he took thorns of the wilderness and briars, and with them taught the men of Succoth a lesson. And he broke down the Tower of Penuel and killed the men of the city. Then he said to Ziba and Zalmunna, where are the men whom you killed at Tabor? They answered, as you are, so were we, excuse me, so were they. Every one of them resembled the son of a king. And he said, they were my brothers, the sons of my mother. As the Lord lives, if you had saved them alive, I would not kill you. So he said to Jether, his firstborn, rise and kill them. But the young man did not draw his sword, for he was afraid, because he was still a young man. Then Ziba and Zalmunna said, rise yourself and fall upon us, for as the man is, so is his strength. And Gideon arose and killed Ziba and Zalmunna, and he took the crescent ornaments that were on the necks of their camels. So getting back to the promises that Gideon made earlier. Before we get to the Midianite side of things, do you see what I see? Do you see any indication that God has said, Gideon, avenge yourself upon them, and I'm giving you the green light because, once again, you were my chosen, you were my judge, and they didn't listen to you? I don't. And you can disagree with me on this one. I'm A-okay with this. I mean, this is not a salvific issue, the interpretation of these verses. I don't see it. I see a man who feels personally slighted, not just in this time, but also what happens later on in this chapter that we just discussed, and feels that his honor, his integrity, his machismo has been threatened. And now he's got to lay down the law as a man versus actually leading as a man of God. So for those two cities, I don't really shed tears for anyone who got hurt there. They're not exactly someone that I'd want to ally myself with or feel sympathy for, but it doesn't mean they deserve what they got unless God had said, do this. Once there, you're good. Gideon's taking things into his own initiative here, not consulting God. And we'll see this is a problem throughout his entire history. It's going to be a problem after the verses we talk about here too. So once again, we see God using an imperfect person, an unlikely hero who ends up falling along the way. This does not mean that Gideon does not have any relationship with God, that he himself will not be raised in the final days, but it's a dark mark on his character, what's happening here. Because yes, I agree, those cities deserve what they got. But just because someone deserves it doesn't mean they need to give it. Get it. You know why? Because you and I, we serve that same God who said, I'm not going to give them what they deserve. I'm going to actually save them, knowing everything they've done against me and will do after they get saved. So once again, I'm not going to say that what I interpret this to be as the gospel. There are other people smarter than me who've gone the other way. And they said it doesn't need to be explicit because, once again, Gideon was God's chosen, his judge. So any action against him in that circumstance deserved to be punished. And I can see that point of view quite clearly. So leave it up to your own interpretation on that regard. Now, why I think I have way more support is in the last part we just read there. So he's captured Zeba and Zalmunna. And Gideon parades them around. It's his right. He's the one who defeated them to those two cities mentioned before. So you're like, hey, oh, by the way, you said we're not going to do anything. I brought them here. What are you going to do now? That's one thing. They need to be brought their sin into account. I'm fine with that. It says, you were not trusting God. Here, God showed me the reward. But then he goes to them, speaks with them clearly, asks them, you know, about, you know, the people of Tabor there. It's like, hey, where are they at? Well, they're all pretty much, they're gone. They kind of resembled you. They looked like a king. We're just saying that to flatter you, Gideon. Oh, by the way, we're related. You killed those people. Well, it's a shame you didn't leave them alive because I'm not going to leave you alive. So my family has been killed. Therefore, I'm going to enact my justice, not consult God once again, even though priests are literally around. Not consult the Urim and Thummim, none of that. I'm going to make a judgment call on my own. Yeah, don't be wrong. Once again, wicked kings, they deserve death. And I think that it is a better world without them in it because they are completely unrepentant. But look at why Gideon does what he does. Is it because you afflicted the Lord's people? Is it because you were worshiping these blasphemous images that aren't even real? No, it's because you killed my family. And then what really ticks him off is when his son doesn't do the job, which is very in character for a son of Gideon, being someone who is timid and not ready to act. And so what does Zeba and Zalmunna do? They question his manhood, and Gideon can't take that. How dare you call me weak for not doing it myself? Gideon's idea in this was that he was teaching his son responsibility. You know, like, look, as we are who we are, we need to, as a people, work together, destroy evil in our midst. That's okay for this specific scenario at that point in time in history. But he twists it for his own ends, and then he twists it even more when his manhood is threatened. And I say this as someone like, men being men is not a bad thing. God made men and women to be different people. Otherwise, what's the point? If everything is just the same, except the only thing difference is this one's called a man, this one's called a woman, nothing else matters, that's stupid. We have our place. We have our position. There's a womanhood to women and that how they're designed, they should be different in this way because they are not a man. And for a man, it's the same principle. We are different because we are men. Things that apply to women don't always apply to us, vice versa. So there should be some actual like pride in the sense of, hey, I do have achievements. Hey, I am who I am made to be. You take pride in that. That's not a sin. The pride of sin is when we take those things that are achievements and accomplishments and go, well, I did that. God didn't do that. I did that. I'm better than him. So yeah, take pride in your biological sex. You know why? Because you're supposed to. But then don't make it something it's not. Don't make it worship of self, as some people do. Some people take bodybuilding to the extreme. It's like they look at themselves in the mirror and say, man, I am an Adonis. I am the greatest gift to the world because I can lift this much. Or I have a wife and several children, and therefore that makes me a man. It's like, no, those things don't make you a man. They can be part of what makes you a man. For those who are called to get married, get married. For those who are called to have children, have children. Love them well, just as Christ loved the church. There's a big difference between, look at me, look how shredded I am. Look what I can do with this body, this physical specimen that I am. Look what I can do versus, hey, who is Jesus Christ? Who are we supposed to emulate in him? Gideon worships self right here and now, because his manhood is questioned. These two men deserve to die, but he kills them for the wrong reason. He kills them because they angered him. Unacceptable. No man of God should act like this. A man of God should have like laughed in their face and said, that's the best you got. I'm quite secure in my masculinity. I don't need to prove myself to you peons. I can stare into the abyss and not blink. It's fine. Just like you, on the other hand, you stared into the abyss and you blinked multiple times over. And that's why you're in the state you're in, Ziba and Zamunda. So yeah, they deserve death. But just because someone is deserving of death doesn't mean you do it incorrectly. Now, there are plenty of serial killers right out there in the world right now. It's not my job to Frank Castle them or anyone who got away from the law. That's not my responsibility. We have courts and a justice system for a reason. A flawed system, don't get me wrong, but the death penalty exists for a reason. Also, we have advocates against the death penalty for a reason so that we can make sure that we're doing it as humanely as possible, even though they want it gone forever. And I think that's a stupid idea, but there is a need to have compassion in the midst of this. Gideon has no compassion for his enemies. Gideon only cares about himself and his son and his family because they are aspects of himself. They're outside of himself, but they keep correlating back to him. And it's that ego that's going to get him and a lot of people in trouble, because he's supposed to lead Israel even after this point, and he's going to fail utterly at the job. And we'll see that by going through 22-35. Then the men of Israel said to Gideon, rule over us, you and your son and your grandson also, for you have saved us from the hand of Midian. Gideon said to them, I will not rule over you, and my son will not rule over you. The Lord will rule over you. Good start. And Gideon said to them, let me make a request of each of you. Bad place. Every one of you give me the earrings from his spoil, for they had golden earrings because they were Ishmaelites. And they answered, we will willingly give them. And they spread a cloak, and every man threw it in it the earrings of his spoil. And away to the golden earrings that he requested was 1,700 shekels of gold, besides the crescent ornaments and the pendants and the purple garments worn by the kings of Midian, and besides the collars that were around the necks of their camels. And Gideon made an ephod out of it and put it in his city, in Ophrah. And all Israel whored after it there, and it became a snare to Gideon and to his family. So Midian was subdued before the people of Israel, and they raised their heads no more. And the land had rest 40 years in the days of Gideon. Jerubbaal, the son of Joash, went and lived in his own house. Now Gideon had 70 sons, his own offspring, for he had many wives. And his concubine, who was in Shechem, also bore him a son. He called his name Abimelech. And Gideon, the son of Joash, died in a good old age and was buried in the tomb of Joash's father at Ophrah and of the Abiezerites. As soon as Gideon died, the people of Israel turned again and whored after the Baals and made Baal-Berith their god. And the people of Israel did not remember the Lord their God, who had delivered them from the hand of all their enemies on every side. And they did not show steadfast love to the family of Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, in return for all the good that he had done to Israel. So we see Gideon here, and he starts off so well. The people of Israel want him to be a king. There are rules in the law for what happens when Israel gets a king. So why not Gideon? And he says, no, guys, the Lord will rule over you, not me, not my son. The Lord will rule over you. Great start. Follow through. Pathetic. Instead, we're going to make this ephod thing here. It's going to be just a physical manifestation of the victory that we won over the Midianites and the rest. And, you know, it's going to be one of those things. You'll be like, well, The priests have one of their own, right? So like, if I can have one too, right? I mean, I work with God. He talked to me multiple times over, so I can have an ephod. I mean, what were those priests doing over there? I mean, they weren't doing their jobs. So why do they get to have ephods and I don't? And this special ceremonial garment and jewelry was given to him as a sign of his victory, as a sign of him giving up the right to be king. Well, let's look at what Gideon actually does, though. Well, he lets the ephod remain there even after people of Israel begin, and this is harsh language, but it's correct language, whoring after it, whoring themselves from God, prostituting themselves to foreign gods and foreign beliefs, and even an insular belief in this ephod thing, worshiping it instead of the one who inspired its making, allegedly, because really it was Gideon. So that's a problem. Then we have another problem here. Well, I'm not your king. Don't treat me like a king, guys. Okay, well, then why do you have all these wives and concubines and 70 sons? Well, that's a lot of mouths to feed, so you must be having a lot of money, Gideon. So people must be supporting you in that way. People must be wanting to get and gain, you know, political favors by having their daughter, you know, marry you. So, you sure sound like a king. Calling yourself a king, you sure sound like one, Gideon. And then the greatest strike against him, Israel served God while Gideon was alive. But when he's gone, what happens? They flip instantly. Gideon failed to be the leader he was supposed to be. Once again, it does not mean his salvation is in question. If he's actually God's, he's God's. He's listed in the Hall of Faith later on. That kind of tells me he gets in. It's kind of the most, one of the most explicit things they kind of be brought up. I'm like, are you in or out? But Gideon is still a failure. Like, you can be both. Hey, don't get me wrong. You can serve God and be a failure, because there are times when you're not actually serving him, even though you're his. And that's an important lesson to take away from this. Gideon was God's servant. Gideon helped save Israel. Gideon also didn't make sure that Israel did what it was supposed to do when he was gone. So no wonder they go after other gods. And yet you'll say, well, look, wait, Christian, you know, it's not against the law. You covered the law. There was no law against polygamy. Well, yeah, except for the king, which he's pretending to be, without saying that he is, number one. And number two, we've covered why just because it wasn't part of the law didn't make it an immoral thing for someone to do. Man and woman, the man leaves his family, be with his wife, not wives. And yet what did Gideon do? Whatever made him happy. He's a success. He was strong. He was courageous, wasn't he? Forgetting all the timidity from before, don't tell that part of the story. He led them to victory. He did it. He versus God, 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 God. Gideon fails because he fails to bring the people to the point where they serve God, not because he says so. And while he's alive, they're going to listen to him because he's the head honcho, even if he's not going to actually be the king, even if he is the king in all but name. And instead, what happens, and Israel continues to happen, people keep searching after what they want more, and they don't want to serve God. And Gideon is to blame for not leading them well and not getting them to stick and commit to God. And once again, look at the life of the judges. These are heavily flawed people. These are not all moral paragons of how things are supposed to be. They are the unlikely heroes, and sometimes unlikely heroes end up as villains in the end to an extent, because they ride the high of being a hero and then lose their way along the way. Even if they're still a hero. I mean, he's still a hero. He's still the person who led Israel. But he's also the person who didn't lead them well after that fact. Both can be true. Let's move on from there to chapter 9, where we see the rest of Gideon's legacy. This good old son of Abimelech, verses 1 through 6. Now Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal, went to Shechem to his mother's relatives and said to them and to the whole clan of his mother's family, say in the ears of all the leaders of Shechem, which is better for you, that all 70 of the sons of Jerubbaal rule over you, or that one rule over you? Remember also that I am your bone and your flesh. And his mother's relatives spoke all these words on his behalf in the ears of all the leaders of Shechem, and their hearts inclined to follow Abimelech, for they said, he is our brother. And they gave him 70 pieces of silver out of the house of Baal-berith, with which Abimelech hired worthless and reckless fellows who followed him. And he went to his father's house in Ophrah and killed his brothers, the sons of Jerubbaal, 70 men on one stone. But Jotham, the youngest son of Jerubbaal, was left, for he hid himself. And all the leaders of Shechem came together, and all Beth Millo, and they went and made Abimelech king by the oak of the pillar at Shechem. You know, there's something to say about parenting, that you can do everything right. You treat your children well. You love them well. You discipline them well. You bring in the church. You raise them up in the faith, and they don't believe through no fault of your own. They decide to rebel. They decide to do their own thing. That doesn't make you a bad parent necessarily. Now, if you did something to cause some of that, we have to talk about it. If you were controlling, if you weren't loving, if you said to live one way and you yourself lived another hypocritically, and the child saw that and rebelled against that, well, that's a little on you. And that's the conversation that needs to be had. But Gideon doesn't have what some parents have, and that is they did everything they were supposed to. Living imperfectly as imperfect people, but owning up to who they were, Gideon doesn't do that. And no wonder one of his sons turns out this way. How about the rest? I mean, the vast majority of them weren't much better. Abimelech was the only one falsely brave enough to try and take it all over. Once again, in the land that wasn't called to have a king. He loves having the high life. And I think there's also a bit of an inferiority complex involved here. And that unlike the rest of his brothers, he himself is the son of a concubine, which means, hey, it's all legal. So you're not acting impurely by the law, but not, once again, the moral law, which supersedes the law. So I think he's looking at, oh, they're all legitimate and I'm not, even though he knows his mother, he knows his father, and it was all done consensually, and everyone recognizes him as the son of Gideon, who, by the way, you may notice, has been called multiple times over, not Gideon, but Jerubbaal. Why? Because he's contending. Let Baal contend with him. How did Baal contend with him? Well, you see the way he's living his life before he died. It makes you think, oh, by the way, Abimelech. Good old funny name, Abimelech. It means my father is king. Let me say that again. Abimelech means my father is king. That should interest you, I think, in how Gideon saw himself. He names his son, my father is king, while at the same time saying, no, I'm not the king, guys. Don't serve me, serve God. No wonder he turned up like he did. Abimelech, father's king. I should be king too. I'm better than my brothers. They didn't get named my father as king. I did. So I'm going to go to my people in Shechem. I'm going to say, look, guys, it should be me, right? I should be king. I mean, dad pretty much was, right? We all know this. Like, he was called king, but we treated him like one. So let's just make it official. That's exactly what happens. How does Abimelech use this newfound power? Does he use it to unite Israel? Does he use it to bring them closer to God? No, he uses it for self. So he goes out and murders every single one of his brothers except for Jotham, and we'll get to him. Because in so doing, what does he do? He's securing his power base. As long as you all are alive, you have a claim to the throne, especially if you're older than me. But if I make myself king, well, you could say the same thing, and that could be a civil war. So let me stop that in its place right here and now. Let me not consult God or the priests. Let me just do things my way. And my way says, you're dead. And not only that, everyone who's funding me, he gives me money out of where? From the temple of God, which would have been immensely terrible stealing. But no, they somehow make it worse. They take it from the temple of Baal Berith. Baal of Berith. And who does he hire to be his chosen army? Does he go David's way and bring the mighty men in who all prove themselves to be exactly who they're supposed to be, men of God, working together as a unit? No. See, that would be, that's not cool. That's not roguish. That's not engaging. What does he do? He hires worthless and reckless fellows, people who like causing problems, people who like living rowdy, people who love living the way they want to live and screw anyone who tells them otherwise, which makes them perfect benefactors of his grand new empire. It's only going to cost the lives of people who didn't deserve it. I mean, Israel should fall in place, right? I mean, God chose my father. Clearly, he must choose me too, even though he's never spoken to me, even though I've never given my mind and attention to him, my heart to him. And that's Abimelech. Abimelech, in many respects, has some comparisons to Absalom. They're not one-on-one. Absalom, son of King David, who decides that he must be king, rebels, causes friction within Israel, civil war. Gratefully, for here, this doesn't get that bad. It's still bad, don't get me wrong. But it could be worse. I can't help seeing the comparison between the two. It's like people who think that divinely are supposed to be in charge, think that based on who my dad was, I should be in charge. My legacy is better than yours. Choose me, pick me, and I'll bring you up with me. I'll uplift you. And instead, all he does is reap death and destruction. Both of them. It's just interesting how that works. So we'll move on from there to get to Jotham's response to all this by going through verses 7 all the way through 21. When it was told to Jotham, he went and stood on top of Mount Gerizim and cried aloud and said to them, "Listen to me, you leaders of Shechem, that God may listen to you. The trees once went out to anoint a king over them, and they said to the olive tree, 'Reign over us.' But the olive tree said to them, 'Shall I leave my abundance by which gods and men are honored and go hold sway over the trees?' And the tree said to the fig tree, 'You come and reign over us.' But the fig tree said to them, 'Shall I leave my sweetness and my good fruit and go hold sway over the trees?' And the tree said to the vine, 'You come and reign over us.' But the vine said to them, 'Shall I leave my wine that cheers God and men and go hold sway over the trees?' And all the trees said to the bramble, 'You come and reign over us.' And the bramble said to the trees, 'If in good faith you are anointing me king over you, then come and take shelter, refuge in my shade. But if not, let fire come out of the bramble and devour the cedars of Lebanon. Now therefore, if you acted in good faith and integrity when you made Abimelech king, and if you have dealt well with Jerubbaal and his house and have done to him as his deeds deserve, for my father fought for you and risked his life and delivered you from the hand of Midian. And you have risen up against my father's house this day and have killed his sons, 70 men on one stone, and have made Abimelech, the son of his female servant, king over the leaders of Shechem, because he is your relative. If you then have acted in good faith and integrity with Jerubbaal and with his house this day, then rejoice in Abimelech and let him also rejoice in you. But if not, let fire come out from Abimelech and devour the leaders of Shechem and Beth Millo, and let fire come out from the leaders of Shechem and from Beth Millo and devour Abimelech.' And Jotham ran away and fled and went to Beer and lived there because of Abimelech, his brother." Jesus is not the only one who can use a parable. Whether Jotham's a prophet or not, up for debate. I see some people say he is as a result of this. I'm not entirely convinced. I think he's just smart and uses that intelligence and wisdom to point out to Shechem and Beth Miller, like, "Look, idiots, you loved my father so much, did you, that you made his son king? Okay, sure. He rejected it. Maybe one of the sons should say yes. Maybe that's the right thing to do. Maybe you did this in good faith, but no. What did you do? You didn't go down systematically through these brothers and let them make a decision. You chose the person who was related to you to get what you want out of this." Funny that. Kind of screwy, ain't it? How that works? Where you're the ones who come out on top on this because you chose the guy aligned with you and you don't think it's going to somehow backfire on you? You know the kind of man he is. You know the kind of people he keeps around himself. And you chose this? I just want to make sure I put everything out on the table. You know, they're all aware, exactly of what's going on here. We're all in the know, you know, one big happy family here. You go out murdering my brothers because of this pathetic excuse for a human being who I happen to be related to. Sure, let's go with that. If you're actually honest with yourselves, you're going to know, when we're destroyed by fire from within, it's because we didn't do the things that Jotham said. We didn't actually deal in good faith to the man, to the family of the man who helped save us from Midian. We did it for ourselves. And when it blows up in our faces, we're going to have no one to blame but ourselves. So keep all that in mind. As we go through 22 through 33, Abimelech ruled over Israel 3 years, and God sent an evil spirit between Abimelech and the leaders of Shechem. And the leaders of Shechem dealt treacherously with Abimelech, that the violence done to the 70 sons of Jerubbaal might come, and the blood be laid on Abimelech, their brother, who killed them, and on the men of Shechem, who strengthened his hands to kill his brothers. And the leaders of Shechem put men in ambush against them on the mountaintops, and they robbed all who passed them by them along the way. And it was told to Abimelech. And Gaal, the son of Ebed, moved into Shechem with his relatives, and the leaders of Shechem put confidence in him. And they went out into the field and gathered the grapes from their vineyards and trod them and held a festival. And they went into the house of their God and ate and drank and reviled Abimelech. And Gaal, the son of Ebed, said, "Who is Abimelech and who are we of Shechem that we should serve him? Is he not the son of Jerubbaal and is not Zebul his officer? Serve the men of Hamor, the father of Shechem. But why should we serve him? Would that this people were under my hand. Then I would remove Abimelech and I would say to Abimelech, increase your army and come out." When Zebul, the ruler of the city, heard the words of Gaal, the son of Ebed, his anger was kindled. And he sent messengers to Abimelech secretly, saying, "Behold, Gaal, the son of Ebed, and his relatives have come to Shechem, and they are stirring up the city against you. Now therefore go by night, you and the people who are with you, and set an ambush in the field. Then in the morning, as soon as the sun is up, rise early and rush upon the city. And when he and the people who are with him come out against you, you may do to them as your hand finds to do. What happens a lot of the times when an inferior successor claims to be the right successor, an equally inferior successor crops up and says, "Or about him, serve me instead. I'm your guy. I'll lead you well." Because at the end of the day, none of the men mentioned here are worthy of leading Israel. Not a single one of them has been called by God to speak in his place and do his will in the world. Now, I know that how even if God had actually lifted him up at some point in time, how he actually wasn't behind them anymore, just like with King Saul, who God raised to be king, unlike Abimelech. But just like Abimelech, Saul was someone who lost the right to be king by how he acted. So God sends an evil spirit to cause discord between the two of them. Now, here's a big question we have to ask ourselves. What does this mean? What is this evil spirit? Well, the simple fact of the matter is we don't know exactly who this is or what this is. It could be its own separate entity who normally would do evil things until God brings forces it into submission to do things that cause discord for the sake of others to actually bring his kingdom further into the world. Some people have said that it's Satan. Just not named as such. And since Satan is still, even in his rebellion, subservient to God, he did it. Others just say that this is a whimsical way of saying that mistrust was placed between each group and God was behind the mistrust. Either way, what we're shown here is that God is in charge and God works against evil, sometimes even allowing evil to work against itself, sometimes even pushing evil to work against other evil, so that both evil groups end up wiping themselves out. I take the interpretation that this is a spirit who, in its very nature, has rebelled against God, whether that be a demon or whatnot, who can tell? But that God, who is still sovereign over nature, looks at it and said, "All right, you want to keep living? Make yourself useful. Cause problems between them. Hey, you want to make yourself useful? Afflict Saul with mental illness because he needs to recognize his need for me and repent. And also, I'm going to use this as an opportunity to bring David there and help soothe his heart so that my kingdom gets further." People say, "Oh, God would never do such a thing. God is love. God can't allow bad things to happen to other people. It's just not in his nature." Well, is it? Have you not been paying attention? God uses evil to bring good into the world. God allows evil men and women to rise up in positions they have no business being in to further his kingdom. While they themselves do evil, he overcomes them. You think it's some mistake that Adolf Hitler raised to power in Germany, caused death and devastation everywhere, and started genociding the Jews? You don't think God was like working against that, allowing it to happen so that his people could have a land of their own after almost 2,000 years of diaspora? And I think, Christian, you mean God approved of Hitler? No. Listen, Hitler was a nobody. He's useless in the grand scheme of things. You know why? Because he's not a believer. He believed in himself. He believed in evil. He caused evil. And God, knowing who he was, used him for his own purposes. Just because God uses someone doesn't mean he approves of them. Go back to Balaam. God used Balaam to bless Israel three times over. And yet Balaam was not a believer. You don't see him in the Hall of Faith later on in Hebrews. And God used evil, an evil force, to fight evil forces in this world. God is not evil. God cannot ever be evil. If he does evil, he ceases to be God. But he can still use his antithesis in evil to destroy evil. And that's exactly what happens here. We have the breakdown of relations between Abimelech and Shechem. Oh, it only took 3 years. And for now, do you recognize, oh, we kind of don't like this guy. He's kind of not really a good leader. Oh, really? Well, you know who told you that? Jotham. You know who told you he wouldn't be a good leader? His father. Without ever saying it. Because you saw how he lived. And you expect his son to be any better? You're not paying attention. And it's going to cause a lot of death and destruction because they chose to do this. So we'll finish off today by going through 34 through 57. We can see how the Abimelech saga ends. The Gideon saga overall ends. So Abimelech and all the men who were with him rose up by night, set an ambush against Shechem and four companies. And Gaal, the son of Ebed, went out and stood in the entrance of the gate of the city. And Abimelech and the people who were with him rose from the ambush. And when Gaal saw the people, he said to Zebul, "Look, people are coming down from the mountaintops." And Zebul said to him, "You mistake the shadow of the mountains for men." Gaal spoke again and said, "Look, people are coming down from the center of the land, and one company is coming from the direction of the diviner's oak." Then Zebul said to him, "Where is your mouth now, you who said, 'Who is Abimelech that we should serve him?' Are not these the people whom you despise? Go out now and fight with them." And Gaal went out, the head of the leaders of Shechem, and fought with Abimelech, and Abimelech chased him, and he fled before him, and many fell wounded up to the entrance of the gate. And Abimelech lived at Arama, and Zebul drove out Gaal and his relatives said that they could not dwell at Shechem. On the following day, the people went out into the field, and Abimelech was told he took his people and divided them into three companies and set an ambush in the fields. And he looked and saw the people coming out of the city, so he rose against them and killed them. Abimelech and the company that was with him rushed forward and stood at the entrance of the gate of the city, while two companies rushed upon all who were in the field and killed them. And Abimelech fought against the city all that day. He captured the city and killed the people who were in it, and he razed the city and sowed it with salt. When all the leaders of the town of Tower of Shechem heard of it, they entered the stronghold of the house of El-Bereth. Abimelech was told that all the leaders of the Tower of Shechem were gathered together, and Abimelech went up to Mount Zalmon. He and all the people who were with him, and Abimelech took an axe in his hand and cut down a bundle of brushwood and took it up and laid it on his shoulder. And he said to the men who were with him, "What have you seen me do? Hurry and do as I have done." So every one of the people cut down his bundle and followed Abimelech, put it against the stronghold, and they set the stronghold on fire over them. So that all the people of the Tower of Shechem also died, about 1,000 men and women. Then Abimelech went to Thebez and encamped against Thebez and captured it. But there was a strong tower within the city, and all the men and women and all the leaders of the city fled to it and shut themselves in. And he went up to the roof of the tower. And Abimelech came to the tower and fought against it and drew near to the door of the tower to burn it with fire. And a certain woman threw an upper millstone on Abimelech's head and crushed his skull. Then he called quickly to the young man, his armor bearer, and said to him, "Draw your sword and kill me, lest they say of me, a woman killed him." And his young man thrust him through and he died. And the men of Israel saw that Abimelech was dead. Everyone departed to his home. Thus God returned the evil of Abimelech, which he committed against his father in killing his 70 brothers. And God also made all the evil of the men of Shechem return on their heads. And upon them came the curse of Jotham, the son of Jerubbaal. People often accuse the book of Judges of just being nihilistic, terrible, unloving, just dark and gritty, and therefore not of any substance. And I see how initially people could think that way. But I find it very hard to believe you can stay that way unless you're actually not taking scripture seriously like it deserves. This is a dark story. This is, at best, a bittersweet story. Don't get me wrong, but this is history. This is people acting like people and God showing us, this is who you are without me to lead you. So no wonder it's dark and depressing. No wonder it feels nihilistic, because people suck. We human beings are terrible at doing a good job of even taking care of ourselves, let alone other people. And that's one of the points of the book of Judges. You're not in charge. You're not good enough. All you do, even when you gather like-minded people together, is cause harm to others. When you are left to your own devices, when you do not listen to me and my word. So don't get down in the dumps simply because stories don't end well in Judges for most people, because they're getting exactly what they deserve. You say, "I have no one to cheer for here." Well, no, except for Jotham, maybe. Well, that's okay. Sometimes in history, things happen and you have no one to pull for. Not everything is sunshine and rainbows. Not everything is, here's a clear good guy, here's a clear bad guy. You have to actually look at people for who they are. And people are not heroic. We can do and are capable of heroic things even without God in our lives, but that doesn't make us a hero. That doesn't make us someone worthy of emulating, worthy of looking up to and saying, "I want to be like them." No, what truly makes us good, what truly makes us a human being, is giving up our right to be a human being and serving God. Because human beings don't serve God of their own volition. They'll do it, you know, if the entire country says this is what we're about, then I'll do it for the sake of placating people, as was the case over a lot of European history. They'll do it if there's a threat of death over it, but they won't do it because they love God. Because they do it without needing all that. What we see in the story of Abimelech and all the other proper nouns brought into this book is that not a single one of them served God. They served self. And they were petty, and they were cruel, and they killed countless people because they were slighted. And the book of Judges is pointing this mirror up to us and saying, you are the very same. And we think, oh no, we're so enlightened now. We're so much better than people of the past. Chronological snobbery at its finest. Look at what these people are doing and then say, I would be doing probably the same, if not worse, if I lived when they did, when the priests weren't doing their job, when I wasn't following after God. I wanted to live my own way. This is the exact same thing that would have happened. Replace the name with yours. Replace the names with mine. Thank God we're not there. Thank God he lifted us out of where we were and said, no. You are going to reject this because you are choosing to be mine. So let yourself live in that choice in the fullness of it. Look at the evils that Abimelech does because he wants to be king, because he wants to be God, and laugh at him as we're supposed to laugh when he's killed by a nameless woman whose city he was trying to destroy out of his own ego and pride, to the point where he can't even allow it to be said that he was killed of a woman. And yet here we are 3,000 plus years later laughing at him because he was killed by a woman. Why is that funny? Because women weren't combatants. This is weird. A real man, as it were, back in the day, would have died in battle against a fellow man. No woman would have killed him. And yet God, laughing at us, laughing at him, says, you think you're so great, Abimelech? I'm going to cause discord between you and your supposed allies, and then I'm going to have you put into a situation where you think you have to go into a civil war to take control, and then a woman's going to kill you. Not because women are some weak and pathetic creatures that it's not even, they're not even worth mentioning, but no, this is your expectation, you idiot. You think you're better than them. You think, if anything, as a king, I deserve an honorable death, and this is not honorable as the people of the time would have seen it. So God does what the people of Israel were supposed to be doing, and he destroys evil from their midst. He destroys it completely and utterly. Abimelech has no one left in his family, that he made. Jotham's still there, the one who actually did what he's supposed to do, but that's his legacy. This man who thought he was so powerful, that thought that his macho nature just meant that he was the one destined to be king, much like his father, even though his father never said it out loud, and was still a better man than his son. Don't get me wrong. Much like that, Abimelech falls so very short of where he expected himself to be. And if we're not careful, we can end up there too. So look at who he is and say, never. May it never be said of me, Lord, that I'm anything like that man. Let me serve you instead. With that in mind, thank you all for what you do. Please, if you get a chance, leave a 5-star review on your podcasting platform of choice. Help us with the ratings there. Help us find more people. Feel free to share the show with your friends and family members. If you're interested in my own fiction writing, you can find my works at starveryunderskilled.com or on Amazon by searching for the name MC Ashley. If you're all interested in some further solid studies into the Bible and its teachings, then check out the other members of the NSL Ministries Podcasting Network. You can find me specifically on Systemic Ecology, What I Don't Like, Friday Night Frights, Spidey Swing Bys, and Some Joyful Noises. You can contact me at lendingthemoviepodcast@gmail.com. I'd like to extend a special thank you to Joshua Noel for the editing that he does and for the music he adds to the podcast. With all that in mind, God bless you in accordance to his will and not mine. Allow me one more time to remind you, let nothing move you.